This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zack. I'm your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger sits down with Dr. Matthew Krennic, who serves as the vice president and senior director of the Socroft Center for Strategy and Security at the Atlantic Council, and with Dan Negrea, who serves as the senior director of the Freedom and Prosperity Center at the Atlantic Council. They discuss Dr. Krennic and Mr. Negrea's new book entitled We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. This book provides a blueprint for Republican policymakers to engage with and win the great power competition with Communist China.
Matt Krennic, Dan Negrea, welcome to Reaganism. Thanks for being on the show.
Roger, thanks so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Delighted to be here. Thank you, Roger.
Well, congrats to both of you on your new book, We Win, They Lose. You can get it on Amazon or any other place where books are sold. And the subtitle is Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. It's got a foreword by Mike Pompeo, other blurbs by Congressman Mike Gallagher, Robert C. O'Brien, Fred Kemp from the Atlantic Council, Walter Russell Mead. Amazing endorsements from leading lights in the conservative movement and foreign policy and national security. Love the title. And why don't you take a minute to explain why you chose to use the words We Win, They Lose to talk about Republican foreign policy and new Cold War. Of course, it harkens back to Ronald Reagan's approach to the Cold War. Reportedly, he shared those words with his first national security advisor and campaign advisor for national security, Dick Allen, explaining how he wanted to deal with the Soviet Union. But Matt, let's start with you. Explain why this was your choice.
Well, a central argument of the book is an idea of a Trump-Reagan fusion that we'll come to shortly. But we think that both presidents were maybe the most significant Republican presidents of the past few decades, that any attempt to grapple with what Republican foreign policy means needs to grapple with both men's legacies. And you look back at how Reagan thought about the first Cold War, and he was coming to power in a period of détente. Others thought that the United States was declining, Russia was becoming more powerful, that the best we could do was kind of lock in parity through a series of arms control agreements. And Reagan didn't buy it, and he was asked by his national security advisor, or future national security advisor, what's your strategy for the Cold War? And he said, well, it's simple, some might say simplistic, but it's we win, they lose. And so now as we, a great quote, and you know, he was elected to office, pursued that clear strategic vision, and by the end of his two terms in office, had essentially won the first Cold War. And so now as we enter a second Cold War, a new era of strategic competition, people are trying to figure out what is the goal of this competition. And we thought we could do no better than look back to Reagan. And we think that we win, they lose also works for the new Cold War.
Well, we're going to get into how we accomplish winning as it relates to this new competition in a bit. But Dan, the other slightly debated, perhaps not slightly, element that's in your title is the new Cold War. Just for give us the argument as to why that is the proper analogy relevant to today, as opposed to those who would say, hey, this is fundamentally different, especially as it relates to the People's Republic of China, than anything we encountered during the Cold War with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the Second Cold War is different from the First Cold War, just like the First World War was different from the Second World War. One was a trench war, the other was a maneuver war, but it doesn't mean that they were not world wars, because what they had in common was more important than what made them different. What is true in this Second Cold War and was true in the First Cold War is that the United States was facing an implacable adversary who had an ideology that was totally alien to the American people, the United States was facing a situation in which, had our adversary prevailed, the world would have been unacceptable to the American people. They didn't want to live in a world dominated by the Soviet Union in the First Cold War, and it would be intolerable for Americans to lose their freedoms in a world in which what we do is dictated from Beijing. And we see how communist China tries to influence speech in the United States, and how it tries to threaten, and actually is threatening, vital and important interests of the United States. And another thing that makes this Cold War similar to the previous one is the existence of important allies of the main adversary. Just like in the first Cold War, we had the Soviet Union, and then we had satellite, what we called in those days satellite states. In this Cold War, we have what we call in the book a new axis of evil. So it's a group of countries that is arraigned against the United States. And just like we said in the first world, that there is a free world and our adversaries, this time we have the United States and its allies in a new free world coalition.
One of the things I like that you do in the book is use freedom and free countries as our comparative advantage, whether it's the military strategy or the trade policy and the like. That clearly is critical and key to winning. But Matt, tell us what winning looks like. Obviously, you break it down in a variety of ways in the book. Can't cover it all here. But if you just had to say overall, let's say you were speaking to President Trump, you read your book with great interest, likes perhaps not the balance in the fusion. He probably would want, you know, more Trump than Reagan. But put that aside, what does winning look like? What do you tell him?
Well, you know, as you know from Trump's speeches, he is a fan of Reagan. It's one of the few past presidents that he often praises. But we say that the goal should be to get to a situation where, well, actually, before I give you my answer, it has been a frustration of mine for the past 6 years or so. We're in this period of strategic competition, but what are we trying to achieve? And very few have articulated a clear end state. So what we argue is we want to get to a place where the Chinese Communist Party and its autocratic aligned countries are no longer in a position where they have the will or the ability to threaten U.S. vital interests. So through a competitive strategy, probably over the course of decades, we get to a place either where the China is so weak that it can't really threaten us, or that a new generation of Chinese leaders give up and they say that was too hard, that wasn't in our interest, we need to try something different. And as you noted, we have a nice foreword from Mike Pompeo, and he had a nice turn of phrase. He said, essentially, we argue that victory is the voluntary capitulation or the incapacitation of the Chinese Communist Party.
Where does freedom fit in your hybrid, you know, this kind of fusion of Reagan, Trump? Obviously, Dan, as we were discussing prior to recording this podcast, it was prominent in the Reagan approach to foreign policy. Less prominent, I think, in the way that President Trump approaches foreign policy. You obviously argue in the book that we shouldn't take President Trump as an isolationist or someone who's purely transactional. But share with us a little bit about kind of the place of freedom in your kind of fusion model and how you see it as something that President Trump leverages in foreign policy.
So one of the greatest things that President Reagan did was to use, you know, if we use the dime, diplomacy, ideas or ideology, military and economics, tools of statecraft, he used the ideology, the I, spectacularly well and critically important in the contest with the Soviet Union by calling the Soviet Union the evil empire, by making clear that we are not like them. We are the shining city on the hill. They are an evil empire. They oppress their people. They oppress other nations. They are the bad guys. There is a clear distinction. There is no moral equivalency. That was not just a nice thing to have, nice thing to say for intellectuals and things like that. This empowered the people in those countries who, in the end, it was they who won the victory. It was the people in the Soviet Union, in the captive nations in Eastern Europe, who rose against their oppressors and replaced them. And not one of the countries in Eastern Europe voted for a communist government yet again. So raising the ideological superiority of Americanism, the fact that we are based on freedom, on rights that we have from our Creator, gave the United States an important competitive advantage against the Soviet Union. And I believe that President Trump, in his America First concept, has implicit the American exceptionalism idea, because in order to stand up for America and make it great again, assumes that it was great at another point where there wasn't the Democrats imposing their view. By the way, as I mentioned the Democrats, before I forget, both Matt and I are at the Atlantic Council, a nonpartisan center. You are going to hear a lot of partisan stuff because it is, after all, a Republican foreign policy book. So we are not representing the Atlantic Council, representing our own points of view.
Absolutely. And the Reagan Foundation Institute is the same in terms of a nonprofit entity. But of course, we take great interest in works that focus on President Reagan, his legacy, and this book, We Win, They Lose, does a great job of doing that on a timely discussion on what Republican foreign policy should look like with the authors here, Matt and Dan. And Matt, let's go to you, because I think your framework, the fusion, and no doubt it's something that is intellectually provocative. I think there's some ways it's intuitive. At the same time, very different people, that is President Reagan and President Trump, and in terms of personality, the way they engage, speak. And then on policy, there are significant differences as well, though some alignment as well. One recent opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal by John Lehman, who, as you both know, was President Reagan's Secretary of Navy, responsible for the 600-ship Navy, and was a national security official in multiple Republican administrations, but most prominently in the Reagan administration, joined No Labels. He's a delegate for No Labels. And the piece reads, Reagan would never vote for Trump. And there are a number of arguments that, in some respects, emphasize the differences. But one thing that I think is, he argues, that I think really goes to the heart of where your book goes, is a fundamental difference. I'll just read you what he says, Matt, and love to get your response. He says, the most fundamental difference between Reagan and Mr. Trump is that Reagan knew America's friends from its enemies. And then he goes on, he'd be horrified by the Republican Party's abandonment of Ukraine at Mr. Trump's behest. And you know, I don't think it's the entire Republican Party, but certain elements. And Mr. Trump certainly is not supporting Ukraine, but he's not, as you know, he's not doing anything outwardly to say that we should cut funding either. He's, in this respect, been somewhat muted. But nonetheless, this idea of Reagan knowing America's friends and from its enemies is, you know, as Dan outlined in the beginning, you know, it was a lasting element of his legacy. And then President Trump, of course, is highly critical of allies, and at times I think is guilty of being too tolerant or supportive of adversaries. And there are plenty of examples we get into. But Matt, give me your take on that difference and how, if at all, it challenges the Reagan-Trump fusion that you write about in We Win, They Lose.
Yeah, great question, Roger, and have a lot of respect, of course, for Secretary Lehman and the great things he accomplished in the Reagan administration. So two points. One, the idea of a fusion is the central argument of the book, and I have to give you and the Ronald Reagan Institute some credit for this, if I may. You host some great strategy sessions, and it was in one of those strategy sessions we were kind of debating the meaning of Trump's legacy, and over coffee, I think a prominent U.S. senator said, really what we need is a Trump-Reagan fusion. And that stuck with me, and I wanted to figure that out, and so spent a couple of years working on it based on, inspired by your workshop. So thank you. And so I think I might respectfully disagree with Secretary Lehman on this point, is that I do think Trump was actually supportive of allies and tough on enemies. And I think it depends on what you mean by being supportive and being tough. So one, I think Trump gave tough love to allies when they weren't doing the right thing. So I think he was right to point out that NATO allies aren't spending enough. They're not. They need to do more if we're going to take on this new axis of evil. And that's not new to Trump, of course. Secretary Gates and others have made this same point. And then second, if you actually look at Trump's behavior toward adversaries, he was willing to strike Iranian General Soleimani when the Iranians killed an American contractor. Despite the, maybe tough language against NATO and solicitous language toward Putin, if you actually look at his Europe policy, increased spending for NATO, let in two new NATO members, killed a bunch of Russian mercenaries on the ground in Syria, built new nuclear weapons and explicitly to deal with the Russia nuclear challenge. So I think a lot of people pay attention to the rhetoric and not the policy and what happens on the ground. And I think if you pay attention to the actual policies that Trump was supportive of allies in a kind of tough love way and pretty tough on our enemies.
Let's jump to Ukraine and NATO. And I think a lot of people who are around President Trump and work for him, particularly in national security, would make the distinction you made, Matt, between rhetoric and what he's done. Recently, President Trump has been pretty critical of those NATO allies that are not doing exactly what you referenced, not meeting the 2% threshold in terms of GDP dedicated to defense, and then making the statement of effectively, hey, we'll invite Russia and Putin to come in and invade. In other words, they're not worthy of Article 5, that is U.S. commitment under NATO to defend an ally that's under attack. Words, as you note, Matt, but I think at the same time, certainly not something that strengthens NATO and deters Vladimir Putin, sort of thing that obviously Secretary General of NATO and even the Atlantic Council are highly sensitive to this, thinks is helpful, but also suggests that this is an area where the fusion construct perhaps doesn't work quite as well. Dan, let's go to you on that. How do you look at those statements from President Trump? Perhaps he shared them after the book was already in print or sent to the publisher. But is it simply just rhetoric and let's see what the action is? Are you concerned somehow that invites aggression or makes even Vladimir Putin think that this would be something he can get away with by invading NATO allies that are not meeting their 2% threshold?
So here is what I would offer here. I would offer a great quote from a journalist who said that people who like President Trump take him seriously and don't take him literally. And people who don't like President Trump take him literally and don't take him seriously. I think it was Senator Rubio who recently was asked this question, and he said, come on, man, this is President Trump. You know how he speaks. I think it's important when President Trump gives comments that are off the cuff not to try to parse the words. I think it's important to see what the effects of his policies have been. The reality remains that Putin was expansionary in action during President W. Bush when he invaded, occupied part of Georgia. During President Biden, when he took for the first time a peace out of Ukraine, and then he tried again under Obama, and then they tried again in 2022 under President Biden. I think President Trump was successful in deterring the adversaries of the United States precisely because they knew that he makes tough decisions, makes them quickly, makes them boldly, and he will defend the interests of the United States. And I think that where he's coming from is, we are in a situation right now where the United States is challenged in Asia, it is challenged in the Middle East, and it is challenged in Europe. It is imperative that our allies in Europe act urgently and decisively to increase their defense spending. And I think he wanted to send a message to them that maybe the United States will not be there to the same extent because the United States itself may be stretched thin. Wanted them to think about this eventuality. And guess what? It works. Stoltenberg wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal where he said, hey, listen, as a result of Trump's tough talk, we got $400 billion more from the Europeans. So I would take his policies to speak for President Trump and not words taken at one point or another. If I may, going back on Ukraine specifically, President Trump, in his characteristic style that needs to be evaluated, said, here is my policy on Ukraine. I will stop the war in 24 hours, meaning quickly. Okay, how will he do that? I will take Putin and I will tell him, you have to stop the war, because if not, quote, I will give Zelensky like I've never given him before, meaning I will give him long-range weapons that can really harm Russia. And then I will go to Zelensky, you have to cut a deal. So that's where Trump is coming out. He wants the war to stop. He doesn't want Putin to win in Ukraine. He wants the war frozen where it is now.
I want to move to China just a moment, but just to follow up on Dan's point, Matt, what does winning in Ukraine look like in this hybrid model? Dan just did the work of parsing President Trump's words and explaining what getting the deal in 24 hours might look like. And it certainly suggests, on the one hand, it's going to get Putin to compromise. On the other hand, it would ask the same of Zelensky. Presently, neither is open to it, clearly. And what does that look like in your mind, Matt? What that 24-hour deal, what that outcome is?
Yes, and I should say that in the book, we do talk about the war in Ukraine. We talk more at the level of high-level principles, because we knew in a book we're not going to be able to predict the next tactic that or weapon system that's going to be needed. So this goes beyond a little bit what's in the book. But early on, I think where a lot of the Reaganites are now is that we should give Ukraine everything it needs other than nuclear weapons to win the war decisively on the battlefield, take back all of its territory. And I think Dan described the Trumpian position well. And I can say that I myself have evolved based on changing circumstances. So 2 years ago, the Atlantic Council published a strategy paper. I was one of the authors. Steve Hadley, former National Security Advisor, was one of the co-authors of that paper, where we essentially said, give Ukraine everything they need to win decisively on the battlefield. But I think things have changed. One, the Biden administration didn't follow our advice. They've been pretty hesitant in the provision of certain weapon systems. Second, the Ukrainian counteroffensive this summer was less successful than many people had hoped. Third, Russia has had time to dig in. And fourth, it does seem like new technologies, including drones and other things, are giving the defense the advantage. So I do think now that the idea of Ukraine winning a decisive battlefield victory, taking back everything, looks unlikely. And so Steve Hadley and I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal recently where we argue that Ukraine should shift to defense, and that if we could get the war to wind down along the current line of contact, not a peace agreement, which I don't think is likely, but if we could get it to wind down, that could stop the killing, as President Trump said, and then create the conditions for security guarantees for Ukraine that I think would advance Ukraine's security and the security of the United States and its allies. But not to ever cede that territory, and we have the West Germany model that over time and diplomatically work with Ukraine to reclaim all of its territory under international law.
Let's move to China, of course. Matt, you've written on this extensively. Great accomplishment of the Trump administration and President Trump by being the first administration to call out the threat of the People's Republic of China for what it is, the pacing threat, the competition, and the like. Dan, earlier you were referencing the ideological component that governed the way President Reagan approached the Soviet Union. Matt, President Trump's approach has not really been ideological, best I can tell, as it relates to the People's Republic of China. Characterize for us kind of the Trumpian approach and how the fusion construct will play out, should play out, as it relates to communist China.
So in our book, we look at the four countries that are members of the Axis of Evil. And when we look at China, we identify them as an adversary that is threatening American interests in the military sphere, in the economic sphere, in the diplomatic sphere, in the ideological sphere, while, say, Iran or Russia or North Korea are mostly in the democratic, in the military sphere. So what the United States has to do with China is really counter their malign actions in every single one of these areas, and recognize that they are a dictatorship at home, a revisionist and hostile belligerent power abroad. And I think that in dealing with China, we need to recognize that the United States needs allies. And we have allies in Asia that we need to mobilize in this contest, but also European allies who have an extremely significant economic power in the world, and also have some military presence that they can contribute, maybe in a demonstrative more way rather than a substantive way in Asia. So we need to recognize that China is a multidimensional threat, number one, and number two, to counter them, we need a system of alliances.
Matt, sticking with that approach, there's one piece in the book, which I heard your voice. It was talking about China and really addressing the greatest failure of the Biden administration, which is a total loss of deterrence. Frankly, this is the era of lost deterrence, and if it is President Trump back in office, I would think that would be priority number one from a national security standpoint. And as it relates to China and Taiwan, you write, the United States should achieve a favorable balance of power at every level of military conflict, starting with strategic forces. And they say the Pentagon needs the ability to sink the Chinese Navy in 72 hours. That is far away from where we are today, particularly as it relates to navies. And we are, in many respects, inferior. Forget about parity and don't have superiority. That will take tremendous amount of resources, a buildup, and you write about peace through strength, the chapter in there. Is that the sort of thing you're seeing presently from the Trump campaign? It's clearly a piece of what you view as the fusion concept, almost alignment, really, between Reagan and Trump, although the rebuild didn't quite go beyond restoring readiness during the first President Trump's first term in office.
Well, I do think peace through strength is a concept that both Reagan and Trump endorsed explicitly. And I think it is part of this fusion that there is unity in the Republican Party on that issue. And if you just look at the challenges we face, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, I think there are basically three parts to how we address it. One is the allies need to do more, which we've already addressed. Second, I think we do need a buildup. U.S. defense buildup. And Roger, you and others who've served on congressional commissions have been arguing for some time that we need a real, you can correct the numbers here, but is it 5% or so per year real increases above inflation? That was obviously part of Reagan's success during the first Cold War, the vaunted Reagan buildup that convinced the Soviet Union they couldn't compete. And I think that's what, and Trump, I think, and his instinct is also peace through strength. And you're right that it maybe didn't go far enough, but it was the largest defense budget in history at the time, after even after accounting for inflation. And then I think the other piece is strategic deterrence, just like during the Cold War, relying more on strategic deterrence. Obviously, Reagan was a big proponent of strategic forces buildup, the idea of a Star Wars missile defense. And I think that's what we need today. And I'm serving as, I think you know, on this Congressional Commission on Strategic Posture. We just got 12 experts to unanimously agree, 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans, essentially to call for the first strategic forces buildup since the end of the Cold War, including a limited missile defense system for Russia and China and the U.S. homeland, which is a pretty big break from past policy. And if you look at Trump's statements in his first term, he said he wanted a nuclear arsenal, quote, at the top of the pack, a missile defense system that's, quote, state of the art. And so I think his instincts are where Reagan's are, that having a strong strategic posture is important for peace through strength.
And if I can add, in several speeches recently, President Trump spoke about an Iron Dome, having in the United States an Iron Dome, like the Israelis have an Iron Dome, to protect ourselves against intercontinental missile from China and from North Korea.
Yeah, it's actually one of the areas, I'm not following Truth Social daily, but seeing it reported, and President Trump has been emphasizing peace through strength, which certainly reinforces what you write about in your book, and an area of emphasis I know that you're both recommending. We're with the authors of We Win, They Lose, new book on Republican foreign policy and the new Cold War. Let's wrap up this conversation before we go into the lightning round. I do want to get your thoughts on the third regional headache. We've covered a little bit about China. We've had discussion about Ukraine and Europe and NATO. Of course, there's a war in the Middle East. Israel responding to Hamas's attack on October 7th on Israel. We have the Houthis attacking from Yemen, disrupting trade in the Red Sea. What does the Middle East policy look like? One of the great accomplishments of the Trump administration, Dan, of course, is the Abraham Accords, and it's endured remarkably since October 7th. The language, perhaps, from some of the Abraham Accord countries has changed, but fundamentally, it's still intact. What would the fusion policy look like as it relates to the Middle East? And you know, with Mike Pompeo writing the intro to your book, certainly it would be continuity from what we saw during the Trump administration as it relates to Iran, which, of course, you could talk about the Middle East war right now, and from the Biden administration, you'd rarely hear Iran mentioned unless you raise it. So Dan, why don't you address that, the Middle East and We Win, They Lose?
So you are correct, Roger. One of the great accomplishments of the Trump administration was the Abraham Accords. But the other great accomplishment was to get out of the Iranian nuclear deal and return the U.S. policy to viewing Iran as an adversary. The Obama administration tried to have an understanding with Iran where Iran would not challenge our interest in the Middle East and entered into the JCPOA deal, which didn't work. They didn't become friends. I mean, the dream of if we stretch out our hand, they would unclench their fist, it didn't work. So in the Trump administration, we recognized that Iran is an adversary, identified them as threatening our military, threatening us in the military sphere, threatening our allies in the military sphere with their ambitions of having a nuclear weapon. Also, by supporting terrorism, and also helping our adversaries in other parts through oil sales at advantageous prices. What President Trump did in his during his administration, introduced a maximum pressure economic policy against Iran, which has been changed under President Biden. President Biden relaxed those restrictions, and now the foreign exchange reserves of Iran went from $4 billion at the end of the Trump term to $25-30 billion today. I think what would happen if we have a Republican, if President Trump becomes president again, what we will have would be a return to a policy where there is maximum pressure on Iran economically and a much more muscular response to any military challenges by Iran proxies like the Houthis.
No doubt. I think that's what to be expected. And I might add, absolutely needed. We see what happens when you extend your hand out to Iran. They basically take whatever you give them and use it to fuel instability, terrorism, and chaos in the Middle East against our friends and allies. And no doubt during the Trump administration, you saw a lot of progress by the way we put together the Abraham Accords, countered Iran, supported Israel. It was sound and was entirely disrupted. Matt, want to end with you before we go to the lightning round, because a key element in the construct as it relates to China more broadly in the fusion here is free and fair trade. I love for you to talk about it. I kind of think of it as President Reagan really pushed free trade and Trump administration really was emphasizing the fair part. In some respects, there's continuity between the Trump administration and the Biden administration on trade. I would have preferred to see some of those trade measures be focused exclusively on China and not extend to allies like Canada in terms of 232 and the like. But Matt, give us your take on what the trade agenda would look like in a future Republican foreign policy.
Well, you know, this was a learning experience for me, because when I went into this, I accepted what I think is the conventional wisdom, which is Reagan's in favor of free trade and Trump is more protectionist. And then going back and looking at the record of both, it's interesting. As you know, Roger, Reagan did levy tariffs against U.S. allies and friends, including European Common Market, Japan, and others. And he was very clear that the goal of that wasn't protectionism for protectionism's sake, but to get to truly fair trade. And he did get Japan to curtail some of its market distorting practices and level the trade imbalance. And Trump also levied, well, first of all, he does deserve credit for upending the failed economic engagement strategy with China, and that took courage. And I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton or Marco Rubio or a more traditional politician would have done that. But then also the tariffs he levied against U.S. Friends and allies, including the European Union, tweeted the purpose, and I don't have the tweet in front of me, but said, you know, this is to bring about, let's drop all the tariffs, drop all the trade barriers, let's make it truly free trade. And so I think it was not protectionism for its own sake, but protectionism with a purpose. And so going forward, I do think you're right that we should prioritize China, which is the biggest predator on the global economic system now. And Dan and I lay out a three-part framework for thinking about trade with China. And so first, we say there are areas of sensitive national security concern, technology, critical minerals, other places where we do need a hard and complete decoupling. Second, we say there are other areas like the film industry where it's not a national security issue, but China is cheating, and that consistent with kind of international trade principles, we should be able to hit back with countervailing measures, tariffs of our own to offset that unfair advantage and maybe to bring about a better trade arrangement. And then third and finally, there are areas where we say that free trade can continue. If China wants to buy soybeans from farmers in Illinois, that's fine. If my kids want to buy T-shirts made in China, that's fine. And so I think by kind of distinguishing decoupling and putting them into these three buckets, we can have a more rational trade strategy with China.
A nuanced approach probably needed. Last piece on it, you do advocate for a multilateral trade agreement amongst free nations, and that's something that the Biden administration has not pursued, and of course the Trump administration chose not to do either outside of USMC, right, which was the NAFTA 2.0 trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. But we'll get to that another time. Let's move to our lightning round. Dan, we'll start with you, and then Matt, you can supplement. This is where we ask our guests to share their favorite Reagan quote, their favorite Reagan speech, and their favorite Reagan book. You can give us all three, two, or just one, or split it between you. Dan, over to you.
So my favorite Reagan book was Peggy Noonan's book, When Character Was King. And you know how it is, you know, you read the whole book and then you're left with one or two or three things. The one thing that struck me in Peggy Noonan's book was how she admitted that she misjudged Reagan, that she took a job in the Reagan administration and she thought that Reagan was stupid. She had this quote that I still remember 20 years, whatever, said, "How wrong I was, how wrong we were. We didn't understand his genius." So that's my favorite book, When Character Was King. She wrote another book, I think, What I Learned at the Revolution, the Reagan Revolution. I think there were two by Peggy Noonan. Okay. The favorite quotes, there are two and they're interrelated. One is, government is not the solution, is the problem. And the other one is, the most frightening thing that you can tell a businessman is, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help." On speeches, I'm sorry to disappoint you highbrow guys, I will not give you speeches, but his jokes. And let me tell you, I grew up in a communist country. Jokes were a form of resistance, because you can't be arrested for a joke, or you could, but it's rare. So Reagan's joke made it behind the Iron Curtain. I'll tell you one of my favorites very quickly from Reagan said, you can go on YouTube and find it. Said, the Soviet Union didn't help people have a happy life. They didn't invest in consumer goods, didn't allow their central planning consumer goods. It was all industry. And so it was a miserable life for people. And said, this guy had money, bought a car, wanted to buy a car, and said, okay, here is the money. You'll get it in 10 years. And the guy says, in the morning or in the afternoon? He said, it's in 10 years. What difference does it make? He said, it makes a difference because the plumber is coming in the morning. So his jokes made the Soviet Union leadership look ridiculous. And you cannot be oppressed by people who are ridiculous, and eventually they were overthrown.
And they were subversive.
His jokes were subversive and were powerful.
That's great stuff. Matt, anything to add?
Well, I don't know if it's too self-serving, but at this point, I think I'd have to say my favorite quote is, "We win, they lose." And my favorite book about Reagan is "We Win, They Lose" by Dan and me. And if that's too self-serving, the other great book, of course, is the still recent book by our friend Will Inboden, The Peacemaker, which is a really comprehensive history of Reagan's foreign and defense policy. And then best speech has to be Berlin Wall and the powerful line of Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
That's a winner. We'll leave it there. Dan, Matt, congrats on the book. Thanks for being on the show. We look forward to having you back.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Anytime.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Reaganism. New episodes premiere weekly every Monday on YouTube and all podcast streaming platforms. If you like this episode, be sure to let us know and share with a friend.